You ready for this?
Yep.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
All right, welcome. David, can you give us your name, your rank, and your serial number?
Serial number? Let me check.
Who are you, and what is your role?
I'm David Fowler. I'm a principal software architect on the ASP.NET team. Okay. And I've been here 10 years.
10 years.
10 years.
All right. So I want to drill in on many of those words.
Yeah.
So let's start with like, all right. So architect is like one of these words that I feel is like super overloaded.
Yeah.
And so what I want people to walk away from is really understanding like your understanding
yep.
of how you view your role as sort of, do you think of yourself as like the ASP.NET core architect? Like what's the
correct.
What's
yeah.
the right way of thinking about it?
So I've been on the ASP.NET team overall for 10 years, different managers, different positions, different roles. And the architect role for me when I first joined was the role where the person who kind of like made sure the entire team had the right designs technically. So it's kind of a mix between a program manager, which does a bunch of like planning and design, but we go deeper. We actually write code sometimes.
Okay.
So you have a mix of writing code and of planning and of design. So you're in design meetings, designing features, but you're also planning the next milestone with the PMs.
I see. So in some ways, like you think about it as like you're intentionally taking a bunch of the roles and mixing them together.
Correct.
It's not like, and in some ways, like you listed project management in there
yeah.
to a certain extent, as yep. well as design, as well as, but obviously you hack a lot of code as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I say that the biggest difference is that I get a chance to work on features that aren't planned yet, and they may become features.
And I
don't have to do the entire thing myself. So I could have a new idea for a feature, do a quick prototype,
okay.
and then have a dev take it over.
I get it.
So you aren't responsible for actually doing all the feature work of everything.
Got it.
It's more you making sure that things are going as planned.
I see. And so like in some ways, you don't have reports, right?
No.
Like you're not a manager. So like
correct.
When you do the handoff, that's like you have minions, but they're not like direct reports.
Right, right.
No,
not minions.
So not minions. What's a good word for this?
What's the word?
Yeah, but they're short and they're pill-shaped and they wear some spiders. All right, no. All right. So, but you have someone who can like take like you, and that allows you to kind of leverage your ability to focus on doing like design work, which
right.
you see as like kind of your
core job.
Job, yep. And then you have other people who are like more skilled at taking that vision and like making sure that it completely
more skilled. More skilled.
Well, there's this concept of comparative advantage,
this
right?
Is true. Yeah,
which
yeah.
is like even if you're a better at typing than the person who in the olden times when people used typewriters,
yep.
you would still have someone do that for you so that you can leverage your time
right.
to focus more on that.
So the key thing is influence but no authority.
Okay.
And that's kind of the key phrase of this IC role that where you're...
We should say what IC roles, because I
sorry,
have like,
yeah.
total ambition that like, people who don't work at Microsoft,
yeah.
A, or B, aren't even in our ecosystem can learn from this.
So an IC is an individual contributor.
Okay.
It means you don't have reports. You're not a manager.
So this is one of the situations where both you and I have only... Have you worked... elsewhere? This has been my whole career.
It's my whole career.
Right. So feel free to, in the comments, tell us when we're jargoning. Because
yeah.
I don't even know if
it's
that's
true.
Microsoft jargon or industry.
No,
jargon.
I think it's industry jargon.
Okay.
I think maybe.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Well, now you know. Individual contributor.
Yeah. So the whole thing is that you have to influence teams and people without having any authority over them. So you can't fire them. You can't tell them, you know, you're getting a bad review. You kind of have to go, we're doing this feature. We should do it this way. I'm an architect. Please believe me. Like, please.
Got it.
Please. So you have to build up rapport and build up the whole like your club of people.
I see.
So they trust you and like.
Right. So it's like reputation management is
yeah,
like the,
basically
the key.
That's the key thing in getting stuff done as an architect.
Cool. All right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what you've built. So architect ASP.NET stuff.
Yep.
So what are the things that like you feel like you had the big contribution to building inside of that work?
So I started 10 years ago. When I started, I was working on ASP.NET web forms.
Okay.
That was pretty fun. I worked on this thing called dynamic data.
Okay.
It was basically a way to scaffold admin pages for websites really fast. And I worked with an architect, actually, very closely, David Ebo, who's left now. But and then did that for a couple of years. Then I worked on...
Were you sort of a dev at this point in the story? Like
yeah,
from
I was his minion, right? So he would throw things at me, and I would just like do his features.
Okay.
And then from then, I kind of got my own ideas, and it kind of gave me.
He
kind of gave me.
Time.
He pushed me off into giving me that kind of power to experiment with stuff.
Sure.
So working on the first thing that I ever did, I worked on a bunch of web forms features.
Yeah.
That basically we showed as the future of web forms. And that's when I knew I was doing something special.
Okay.
Because we had an MVP summit, and they were showing the things I built in my free time.
So the MVPs are...
Sorry, the... Yes. Yeah, you explain it.
All right, so the MVPs are like the Microsoft most valued professionals. They're like, would you call it like super enthusiasts who work closely with the product teams products, and we bounce ideas off them, and then once a year they come in for the summit where, is it once a year?
Once a year.
And they come in and we share ideas. But so, of course we get their information all the time.
So I've been working in my free time on a couple of prototypes for web forms, and my team showed it as like the future of ASP.NET web forms, and I was like, wait, I just had these things together in my free time. How come they're being shown as like the thing we're doing? I said, okay, so this is a thing that I'm doing that actually seems to have value, so I'll just keep doing it, right?
Right.
So we kept doing
that. Sort of like where you established the pattern that you wanted to later get
to?
Yeah,
I think it made the team realize that this guy could do some stuff, right?
Okay.
I could throw stuff together and have a prototype working quickly. So then we ended up working on this thing called Plan 9 with Codename. It was basically a compete for PHP style sites. The whole goal was to make it easy to write web pages in .NET. And it was too hard because it was too much web forms and stuff. So what if you could just write code in pages again, like PHP, right?
Got it.
That whole effort spawned a bunch of tech. Razor, our rendering engine, template engine. It spawned NuGet. And NuGet came about in a really fun way, actually, where NuGet, we had a package manager in the web page, and we thought that was the coolest thing ever, where you can install packages in a random application. It's not secure at all, but you know, we didn't ship it, so
you always add that stuff later.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, yes.
So we ended up having a meeting with Scott Gu. It was me, Phil Hack, and David Ebel, and we showed our prototype for the in-browser version, and Scott Gu had been thinking about gems for Rails.
He's like our president.
Our big boss.
Yeah. Guy in the red shirt. I only wear blue. Okay.
Yeah, I don't wear black. He had been thinking about Ruby on Rails, and our compete with Rails and Gems was their package manager, and we didn't have anything. And there were a couple of package managers that were being made by third parties, and we had been working on NuGet. So we kind of got together, built NuGet, and that was kind of the first time I remember I got to use computer science at work.
Like in the theoretical sense?
In the theoretical sense. All before that,
we write some code here.
No, you know, you do all the algorithms and you do all the CS stuff, and then you come to work and you're working on like fixing the build.
Yeah, sure.
and that was the first time I got to use like graph theory and graph walking and like that. And so it was cool for me from that point of view.
Got it.
And I didn't really understand the impact that NuGet would have like on the whole
.NET ecosystem.
Yeah, going forward, it just felt like this is a cool thing I'm working on right now. And then we saw it grow and grow and grow. I think that was one of the bigger things that I think had a bigger impact early on. We wrote the server, the client, it was all crazy. It was us running a live service where like, we had no idea how to do it, and it would go down, and we would patch it in production like you always do.
Yeah.
Those are fun times.
I guess it's probably worth mentioning that at this point, like running services at Microsoft was still a new idea.
It was pretty new, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure where it ran. Like, there was no Azure. I think it ran
box
on
under
some
your
guys.
Desk.
It ran on our maybe on David Ebel's like machine. the first version was actually on CodePlex.
Okay.
It was repository, and we took pull requests for new packages, and then that outgrew its like size. And
yeah.
Like, let's make a server with a protocol, and then we use OData. And then you know, as the scale grew, things kind of fell apart. So we had to make a brand new server that was actually scalable. I did that for about two and a half years, built the whole team. I was the first dev on NuGet.
Okay.
It's funny because when the NuGet team comes and talks to me, some new dev, I was like, yeah, I wrote that. that's my code. I'm sorry.
You gotta be careful because if you manage for too long, they take all of your code out and you
this
can't
is true.
Do that anymore.
Although an intern last year was like, yeah, I removed some bad code from NuGet, and I was like, that was my code.
No hire! David's like, no!
Fired! No, it's fine.
Can't fire people, guys.
Fine.
You can do this whatever you need. Take an
authority,
internship at Microsoft.
No authority. No authority at all. I can't fire anyone. So that was first. NuGet was first. And then I was, at the same time as Plan 9 and NuGet, I was working on the side with Damien Edwards on this thing called SignalR. And I had been doing it, I'm not sure why I've been doing it. I have been working on this thing that I call SkyDE. So you know how we have,
SkyDE, like IDE with Sky?
Yeah, so like Cloud IDE.
Got it.
And the whole idea was to have a file sharing, a kind of a code sharing experience. So I want to make it so that you're in VS, I'm in the browser, I can share my thing with you. So like live share.
Oh, cool. Right? Yeah.
But like 7 years ago. So much, much earlier than live share. But worse, a worse version. A much worse version. They didn't work at all. So I was building this thing, and I had to make it work with like ASP.NET.
Okay.
So I started to work on a library to make it so I can collaborate over long polling between VS and between my web application. And then that turned into this thing called Signaler. And I saw Damien had given a talk at a conference about how you can do long polling in ASP.NET. Because there were no good blogs or anything on how to do it. So he had given a talk on how to do it. And I had seen it. So then I had gone, oh, wait, he works here.
Oh, I see. You guys weren't working together.
No, no. So I built a thing. He gave a talk about it. I went to him and I said, hey, we should. I did a thing. You should come see my thing.
I see.
And then he saw
it. So it was organic, actually.
It was organic, yeah.
Okay.
And then we started working after work on Link, I think it was called at the time. Like Link, not Skype for business.
So you called a different thing? LYNC.
We talk on.
Oh, great.
We talk over that. Like after dinner time, we'd be on that thing until midnight.
Okay.
Because he's an old man, he went to bed early.
I see.
I was up all hours of the night working on this thing. We built the first version. It was not a Microsoft product. It was open source.
Okay.
And we put it
was
on.
Was this like literally like moonlighting?
It
like
was literally, yeah. It was actually moonlighting. Where we at work, we didn't work on it. We went home, opened a different version of Visual Studio.
Like an older one? So you didn't have to dog food?
Probably Express.
I see.
So we didn't have to like.
Hey, that's cool. That's in the license, man. It's open
exactly,
source.
Right?
You can do that.
So we put it on Bitbucket. It was our first experience doing open source in real life. It seemed it. I think what made it pop, it was so easy to use. You could do chat in like 5 lines, which maybe in hindsight was a bad thing because people end up like having unscalable chat because they think you can do like WhatsApp in 5 lines.
This is like a, if your sample is too good.
Your sample is too good, so like
yeah.
Signaler is so easy to get started. Like, it really is, but man, at scale, it's really hard.
Got it.
So we put it on Bitbucket. That lasted for a while, and then we had a conversation with Scott Hunter, who was our boss at the time, and he said we had an agreement that after we shipped Plan 9, we would make Signaler a Microsoft product.
Okay.
So it got transferred from like our ownership to be a Microsoft product, and then we got
like you had tested like is like that like a process you like a test ownership. Or
it,
something like that?
We had to sign a thing actually. It was the first time we had done like a copyright handover to Microsoft.
Hope you had a good lawyer there.
Yeah, I mean, I got my lawyers. I lawyered up just to make sure that things were all the legalese were perfect. It was perfect. It's funny, at the same time this was happening, I had been working on this thing called Kudu. You know what that is?
I don't think so.
So Kudu is the Azure App Service Git deployment technology.
Oh, cool.
So when you do Git push to App Service, you use Kudu. And that was me and David Ebel working on this thing. So I had been working on that.
That was like your day job?
Yeah, so my day job had been going from Plan 9 to working on this thing. Because at that time, Azure had just been like, it had been out already, but it had been really hard to use. And App Service was just coming out and saying, OK, I can deploy.
Host your web page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Host your simple website on Azure using App Service. And I think it was called something else back then, like websites, Azure websites.
Yeah.
And we had been working on, me and David Ebel had been working in our day job on Kudu. So I've been doing it like in my day job, and then in my free time, I've been doing Signaler. So it's kind of like split-brained.
Got it.
And as Kudu kind of got booted and was working, like maybe a year and a half in, and I got promoted to senior, and then I had to make a choice. Like, do I want to keep working on Kudu? Because by then, the team was being reorged to move into the Azure team.
Okay.
So I had to choose at that point.
See.
Do I leave and go work on Kudu on Azure websites? Or do I stay and keep working on Signaler? And it.
So this is the road forks.
This was a man, should I change?
It's interesting
things?
That the choice. If you so, of course, one of our goals here is to kind of sit down and think through like where are the places where you had to make a decision.
Yeah.
I have a thesis which I'll lay forth, which is that there actually tended to not be as many of those in people's careers as you think. A lot.
Interesting.
I find that most of the people I talk to kind of weirdly just create these environments where they fall into things that are awesome, and creating that environment is the thing. But this is like one of those forks in the road.
Yep,
and interesting to me is the fact that it was organizational.
Yeah.
Right? Like effectively there was a reorg, I guess,
and
you had to choose left or right.
Yep. And it was hard for me because that would have been the first time I wouldn't have had my architect that I had been with the whole time at Microsoft.
Ebo in this case.
Yeah. So we had been working together the whole time on everything, basically. Yeah. Everything we had done was together. And then I was kind of like, okay, do I branch off and I'm that guy now, or like, is it time to like leave him and let things go?
Because he was going to Kudu.
Yep, he was going there. He was already set on App Service as his thing. So eventually we split. You know, he went to work on App Service and I stayed on Signaler. And when we had finished like that work, we actually got a whole team to work on Signaler. And this was kind of like a moment for me where I went from being just a senior dev to being like the lead of this team. And there's no
technical lead.
Yeah, so there's no like, there's managers and there's ICs at Microsoft. There's no tech lead position officially in the title.
Yeah.
But I was like the person on the team responsible for making
it's
the
decisions. Informal,
yeah, it's an informal thing.
Right.
So it had been me and Damien running this entire team. And we actually got like
Damien's the program manager.
Yeah, the program manager.
Yeah.
We got, I think it was about 5 engineers working on it, like 2 new hires from college that were really good. And
so you felt the scope expansion.
So it felt like, wow, like I got a team to work on the thing that I built like in my free time. This is a thing here happening that's kind of cool. We got our own. We made a fake team room because back then there were still offices. We had we got some conference room that was like offline.
Now we're gonna get negative comments because you said team room. We're sorry.
We had a team room.
I'm sure your opinions about team rooms are very, very tightly
amazing.
Held.
They're amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. And we went through the experience of going from an open source side project by a dev and a PM to a real Microsoft product with like security requirements, and like it was an insane couple of months to make it go from that product to like a real shipping product.
Got it.
Bunch of bugs were found, security bugs, security reviews. So the level of investment that we had before compared to like after it became a product was immense.
Got it.
And the amount of stuff to go through and like check boxes to check to make sure you can ship it as a product that was serviceable and patchable was like eye-opening for me. So then Signaler kind of like, we shipped it 1.0 and like caught on. People used it like everywhere. It was kind of the thing that I thought would be impactful, but I didn't really understand how impactful.
Got it.
Where like 5 years later, even now, people are like just discovering it and going like, oh my God, it's so easy to use. And I'm like, oh, wow, this isn't new at all. This has been here 5 years, but it's still super useful.
Do you like? I don't know if we should share it or not. Do you have like a number? Do you have a sense? Like, I obviously don't have that kind of thing because it's people deploy. But do you have a sense
of how many people use Signaler?
Yeah.
I don't know off the top of my head. I a lot.
Yeah. How many Twitter followers you got?
I'll tell you. It's used in places that I would have never thought it would be used in the first place. It's used in Visual Studio in various extensions. It's used
it's basically anywhere you want to connect two things and have them communicate through a pipe and achieve.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we learned the hard way doing Signaler in the first place, I learned a couple of technical problems that we solved. Like doing distributed systems in general is really hard. We went in being a team working on a single framework, single box was the main thing. And then doing Signaler kind of was a different kind of scale, a different kind of level of problem. And going into it, you know, I go in with first principles. You know, if I'm doing X, I didn't read the theory. I just like solve it doing these things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's logical. It makes sense. And then you learn the theory, and you're like, oh, that's why it's about it. It's a guaranteed order at mass scale with infinite retries.
I see.
And like,
but because you weren't coming from a distributed systems
background. Yeah. So we learned that the hard way. Like,
did you like add people into the team that could help fill those things, or you basically bootstrapped yourselves?
We spoke to various people in the company that knew stuff.
I see.
And we got feedback from those people.
So because you had sort of a network
available
of people who could like supply the expertise that you guys didn't have,
It's
not like you had to like go to the Microsoft
exactly.
library
yeah,
and
exactly.
like go.
Yeah. So eventually, I ended up learning just by nature of helping customers solve issues and fixing bugs, the kinds of things that you don't that you design for when building a system like this at scale.
I mean, like, do you feel like you? So obviously you didn't have to throw it all away in.
Oh, no,
like ended up working. So was that like a situation where you just feel like you just had okay instincts and that's why you landed in a place where you were able to keep the design even though you didn't necessarily have the skill set that you have now?
Yeah. I think it was more, we had a bunch of smart devs on the team in general. So people were just like talking about things in general. So we knew a bit about some things like theoretically.
I see.
And we kind of designed for that. And we had some help from Clemens Vasters, who is an architect on the Azure Service Bus team. He helped us design some of our scaling primitives.
I think that helped us. There are design analogs in their world.
Exactly, yeah. It's actually a really good match. Because we supported, if you have Signaler on 2 machines and you want to broadcast to all users, guess what? If you're over here, it has to get to this machine somehow.
Yeah.
So
there are
we had a plugin. It's called Network. We had a plugin for Service Bus, and Clemens had written the first version of that.
Cool.
Using our extensions. So he helped us design that whole thing, and it helped me learn about the systems. And it helped me understand what mistakes we made in the whole design of Signaler and what kinds of things the next version would or wouldn't have.
Got it.
Right. One of the big things that I think we did, like things I saw, bugs that were very common that customers had that were hard to solve or unsolvable in the older version, was because of choices that we made really early on. So in the new version of Signaler, we said, okay, we'll start by saying we learned these things before. We will make it so that you can't do them yet, and you have to write your own code. And then if everyone complains, then we'll make it easier.
I see.
So we took the approach of let's not try to be everything to everyone by default, but make it really easy to use and easy to ramp up on. And then for the really hard problems, we'll take it one at a time and solve some of the issues, not all at the same time.
Got it. So like sort of prioritization.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yep.
Got it. Do you feel like are there any major regrets in the story? Like, or do you feel like there was is there like one thing that you would wish you hadn't have done that you can talk about that?
I'd say so adding support for scaling out Signaler to multiple machines is not a regret. It's a thing I wish we understood more about before jumping into it.
You would have looked at that earlier.
So we shipped 1.0 without it. We shipped 1.1. We added it, and then that was me doing the feature. I did that whole feature myself. And we designed it, but I wrote all the code for that feature.
Understood.
And some of the design choices that we made were just insane.
And was it just and then you got a major version number, so it allowed you to undo those decisions?
Is that
okay?
Yeah. So for example,
fatal flaws, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
We had a cache of 1 million by default, and then everyone was we're leaking memory, and I was oh, maybe that's too big. those kinds of things were that should have been obvious while doing it. We're just interesting. That's bug.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Do you want to talk about anything after Signaler before we transition into the next section?
Same thing. So there's NuGet, Kudu, Signaler, and then I worked on. So I think after Signaler, people saw that I had a track record for getting stuff done, and maybe running a team or running the design of a big thing, right?
Yeah.
So then I got entrusted with being one of the architects for ASP.NET Core. It was me and a guy called Louis Desjardins.
Uh-huh.
We got told by our managers, hey, we're trying to work on this brand. And by the way, it was called ASP.NET 5. There was no core at all at this point.
Yeah.
We had a thing called Katana and Owen from the older stack that we were kind of trying to figure out how to move that forward.
Uh-huh.
We got told, we're making a thing called ASP.NET 5. We want you guys to lead it. Just go figure it out. So at this point, I was like, okay, I'm still working on Signaler. I'm still fixing bugs. I'm still in the day-to-day. How do I pull out?
Do you, think about this as making a transition from tech lead to this is when you start to actually become baby architect
and
or something?
It didn't feel so. I was still devving on Signaler, still writing the code, fixing the bugs, answering customer issues on Stack Overflow and GitHub.
80% or something?
Yeah, 80%. I was still in it, right? I would design features, but I'd still be coding things every milestone. When we did ASP.NET Core, when I moved to that role, that felt more okay. You don't have to code anymore. You don't really have to. You can if you want to. But your job is to make sure that the whole team knows what to do.
Okay.
And we kind of sat down, me and Lou, and we wrote a bunch of prototypes, demoed a bunch of things at the next MVP summit. Remember, I demoed a thing that was basically the future of ASP.NET Core. And it was me on stage showing Project JSON and the whole dynamic compilation model. And we went and we wrote a thing. And we came back and said, this is what we're going to build. And then...
After selling it to people.
of course.
Here's pitch worked.
Pitch worked.
We were just talking about the Fire Festival before this. I'm just pointing that out. All right.
This is not... Okay. Maybe Project JSON was Fire Festival. But ASP.NET Core started, and it was a big project. And we basically had air cover from our managers. And it was the first time I felt that much autonomy. It was a little bit scary at first. It was there's being responsible, and then there's okay, you can do whatever you want, and your manager will cover you, and hopefully you make the right choices.
Yeah, the accountability, though, right?
It kind of feels okay, let me...
I shall.
and we learned about being a bottleneck. So there was a big team working on ASP.NET Core, and every single design decision was going through me and Lou. And it got to a point where we became like this bottleneck and this funnel.
Got it.
Where everyone, people that want to design a thing,
yeah,
were coming to us and going, okay, I have this problem. And we're like, okay, I'm doing these 10 other things. I can't do this right now. So we made a thing called labs, lines and boxes.
Okay.
So every day during the week, we'd have like open hours for like lab designs.
Okay.
Where someone would bring in their design issue and we'd go over it in the board like a diagram.
Oh, I see boxes and lines.
Yeah. Lines and boxes. Yeah.
Gotta be different.
Yeah. And it was his name, labs. We're gonna do labs.
I guess bounce doesn't sound as good.
And it helped us kind of like find out the problem. And this is where I began to learn about trusting other people.
Got it.
That sounds bad. What I really mean.
Whatever. I mean, like, we all go through these things, right? Like,
so it went from me having control over the code that I was writing and everyone.
Letting go process.
Yeah, and code reviewing everything to having to, like, not being able to review everything. And it was really hard for me.
And to be clear, in some ways, I think, like, yes, the architect role is ambiguous.
Yeah.
It's actually one of its defining characteristics.
Yep.
But in some ways, that's the thing about it. It's like, you're probably not an architect if you can't, like, delegate in the individual contributor sense of decisions to other people and building that trust.
And you have to let other people grow as well, right? Like,
right.
I didn't want to micromanage everyone's decisions, so you have to kind of let people make decisions and then kind of like keep them on course, but don't grab them and tell them to do X.
Pick your battles.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I remember there was one situation that happened, I won't mention any names, where a dev designed a feature. He went overnight, he got requirements from the PM, he designed the feature overnight, he came and showed us, and somebody had a different idea of what they wanted. Not an idea, they had a different implementation.
Got it.
In their head. So whatever they were shown, this wasn't the answer.
Because it didn't match the vision they had in their head.
Yeah, so then like, as a result, that ended up being not a great thing because the dev didn't feel like he was empowered to make decisions.
Right.
That's when I began to realize, okay, this role isn't
really
about.
So why am I coming
about,
in the day?
This isn't really about me being right or me having the answers to this, to some problem. It's really about like making everyone more productive.
It's like creating the environment.
Yeah, it's the right environment. It's the right technical leadership and guidance for people to not only tell them what to do, but to tell them like to give them free roam and have them tell you what they think is right or wrong. So I had to learn how to go from we should do this to what do you think we should do? Interesting. Let's see how we can tweak that to match whatever the goal is.
So what got you from A to B? Is it like you just had this realization at one point?
Got beat into it.
Well, I mean, sometimes that's what it takes, right? You have to bang your head against something.
I think it was the scale. The amount of people that were coming to me and asking for like
made you make choices.
How to do blah. I had to like to prune. I had to go. I cannot micromanage every single decision.
I see.
Even with two architects, mm-hmm. we couldn't manage the workload.
So in some ways, if you're working forward, like at each of these sort of transition stages, it was basically you had to identify what the skill was that you needed at that point.
Yep.
And then basically you allowed the time management
to
force you to do the transition that you needed to
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Yeah. And
that resonates with me as a manager.
It took me maybe I would say only 2 years ago, I really felt like I had let go.
I see.
Enough. I still felt like I was like, oh, I have to do this thing. And then after a while, bugs stopped getting assigned to me. And bugs that were assigned to me were counted as bugs that weren't going to happen. And I was like, man.
Instead of using a tag, you just assign it to David?
I get it. So like, people were like, okay, I can't assign the bug because he's the architect. He isn't the one that's going to fix it anymore. And I felt, wow, there's a thing happening here. This is different. That's when I knew I wasn't just a...
That was your like looking back and seeing what had happened. I see.
I wasn't just a principal dev. I was like a person who wasn't supposed to be in charge of writing the code for a feature at that moment. I was more, hey, the bug is assigned to him, but you know this should be assigned to a dev who's going to work on it, and David can give the feedback this bug.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's transition. Let's talk about, so we did one of these already. I want to work backwards in time, and I want to see the places where you felt like you had to make a choice.
Yep.
Are there others? Like, is the one that we talked about where there was a reorg and you had to pick left or right? What were the others?
One was a reorg, too. So we had a bunch of, I had a bunch of reorgs.
Microsoft is really good at career development by a reorg, I guess.
There was one where I recall us having a choice while working on Signaler to be merged into Service Bus.
Okay.
And I was like, whoa. We we had been merged into the Azure org as a whole.
Yeah.
But then there was going to be a different fork.
Okay.
And I went, huh, I have to decide if I want to, like, if Signal's going to move with this thing or if it won't. And I had a choice to, like, do we want to have the team go there? Like, have Dev be a different manager? And I said no. And we kept Signal in ASP.NET. I think that was a good choice overall. But it had been a whole, like, conversation. Like, should we put Signal as, like, an Azure thing? Should it be part of Service Bus?
And, like, what do you feel like? What made you? Like, we don't need to replay the entire decision, but I'm curious, like, what you learned or whether you feel like you did that well or if you would have learned anything from the process of making that decision.
What everyone always told me, and this isn't a stain on any specific team or manager.
Yeah.
Working with a good manager that you like and that you enjoy working with is super important.
Okay.
And it for me at that point, it was like, I like my manager, my management chain. I think I'm doing well over there.
You felt like you were getting the support you needed.
Yeah.
And so rather than taking a variable into there where you'd be adding risk.
Yeah, exactly.
You felt could still grow.
Yeah. I felt like I had ultimate autonomy while working on ASP.NET Core. I felt like I was at that point where, like, why change this right now? This feels like I'm still, like, in the middle of it. I don't want to.
Is it fair to say, like, you're still able to turn that into the sort of the juice, right?
Yeah,
like
it was that,
And that, like, yes, you by no, there's an alternative universe, you know, in the Marvel multiverse where you're over here working in Service Bus and you reestablished all of those things. But you felt like because you had that support structure in there, why take the risk?
Exactly. Yep. Right. Yep. I'm trying to think of a different time where it happened. I say every time I move from my previous project to the new one, like moving from NuGet to Signal was tough too.
Was that intentional? Did you choose that?
I chose that one. I had to move between my two children. And it felt like, man, NuGet. And NuGet wasn't, like, done. It was, we were growing the team. Mm-hmm. There's a
lot of people working.
And now it's like huge, right? There was a server team and a client team. And I had been working on, like, both. And I had been, like, the NuGet guy because I had been there from the beginning. And, like, I had been working on Signal in my free time, but now I was getting the chance to have to, like, lead Signal. I was like, I can't not.
So in this case, in the last one, the decision was between, like, you know, support. This one was about there was just a baby, and you just needed to make Sophie's choice between child one and child two,
and go
in there, and you just felt like there was so much potential inside of Signal, and that was the signal that you just basically went with.
Yep.
Cool. Yep. Okay. How'd you pick this place?
Microsoft?
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny. So I went to college in Florida. I call it the MIT of Florida, which it isn't. It's FIT, Florida Tech.
Okay.
And I went there because I knew Microsoft went to the career fairs.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is some long-range planning.
I did some research, and I picked, I mean, they go to a bunch of colleges in America, but I chose Florida Tech because they had a good CS program, and because there was a career fair that had Microsoft. And I heard they didn't recruit, like, freshmen. It was too early to recruit freshmen. So you'd only go to
like for an intern?
Yeah. So you go to the career fair in your, like, senior year when you're almost done.
Okay.
Or junior year to get an internship. And my freshman year, my friend and I wrote a game. We made a game. And there was EA there and Microsoft.
You mean Electronic Arts?
The
company?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And we showed the game to Electronic Arts and to Microsoft. And we got interviews.
Awesome.
Because they were like, oh my god, you guys wrote a game? Like, because we didn't know anything. Like, we just, I remember writing.
I'm sure you knew a thing.
We didn't know anything. We didn't know any theory. Any theory.
Okay,
because first year, you learn, like, intro to Java.
I
have been coding way before, like, this, like, college, right? So we did
Java,
like,
is that thing. It's like C#.
It's like C#, okay. But, like, less var. Less var.
We love the entire
ecosystem. Love
Java. Yes.
We wrote Java client for Signal. There we go.
Yeah. So you were learning theory.
So, like,
you weren't learning theory.
So, for example, in the game, we wrote a parser for math, right? So you could, like, evaluate expressions in the game.
It's like the traditional first build a calculator app,
so,
but in your game.
But it was, like, parsing in fixed expressions and trying to, like, evaluate things. Like, we didn't know the theory behind it. So I wrote a thing just based on, like, first principles that I thought was, like, right.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out it was right sometimes, but then other times it was just, like, completely wrong, right? Because it didn't have the right precedence and ordering and stuff. And then my friend went to logic class,
uh-huh.
and he learned about RPN, reverse Polish notation. And then he was like, oh my God, I've solved the problem. And then like, that was our first learning about writing a parser and that. And we were at that stage. I hadn't taken any course in algorithms yet. And we got interviews. So I interviewed for an internship. And my school was known for testers. We had a software testing degree. Okay. So I got put in a bucket from the get-go.
They were SDET.
Like, yeah.
Which was basically Microsoft up until about five years ago, we had three disciplines. It was software development engineer in test, and program manager.
Yep.
So you were SDET.
Yeah. So I was
intern.
So I didn't know that at first, by the way.
Well, yeah.
So during the interview, I had to go like study super hard because I had not done algorithms yet. So I had to go learn a bunch of things.
So you like, can reverse that linked list.
Yeah, so I got asked all the weird brain teaser questions that they asked before we cut those questions. I hope we cut those questions.
We did.
Yeah, so like, I got asked the question about how do you count the number of gas stations in Florida? And I remember sitting down going...
I like that they localized the question for you.
Yeah, I asked them. I said, is that a trick question? I asked him, I was like, is this a trick question? And he said, no, and I was like... What? So I got the interview. I interviewed for my internship. I flew out to Microsoft. Interviewed. I remember being in the hotel room with the algorithms book like open. And I just like passed
like
out
CLR,
with my face in the book. So I was just like reading. I was like I'm gonna fail. I'm reading about heaps and trees. And I didn't
so
learn.
So this is very much just in time.
I didn't learn it in
just
class.
Just in time learning.
Yeah, I was just like, man.
How'd you do it the night before in the hotel room?
Yep. Got the interview. Got internship as an SDET on the ASP.NET team.
Okay. Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So the continuity
from internship. Yeah. And then I, at the end of my internship, I told my manager this was a great internship. I want to be a developer. And I interviewed to be a developer at the last day of my internship.
Oh, good.
To be a developer intern. So I came back next year as an SDE intern.
And then you sort of rolled the intern program into full-time.
Yeah, full-time offer. And then
get him young, folks.
Yeah. Trapped.
Go to Florida.
I went to Bill Gates' house. I was the last
class
group to go to a Bill Gates' house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we still do a pretty good job.
They get like artists know right. that flight.
Well, that's what we should do. You should send us Twitter requests. If you're an intern at Microsoft, we'll let you go over to David's house. He's got some work in the backyard.
So lame.
He needs to get done.
I was this close to Bill Gates. I was like, so the intern at the intern event at his house, they take your phones and stuff because you can't take pictures at his house.
Fair.
they took us to like a church, I think, and like they said hand the phones over. And,
like, I would just like swear on the Bible or something.
And I think there was like a metal detector to detect like stuff, and they like took our stuff and went to his house, and we were sitting on his like epic lawn, and then someone shouts, "That's Bill Gates!" And I remember standing up and like turning around, and he was like, the interns had formed a circle, and I was in the middle of the circle, and he was like there, and I was like,
and interns,
and they're all trying to sound super smart by asking him like questions that sound super smart, and I'm just like. Shell shot like
my closest touched by greatness stories is like one time when I was at my first conference with customers. I came out of the bathroom in a Japanese like conference hall, and then I bumped into Balmer as he was on his way to the stage. So yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah,
nice.
He's bigger than you'd think in this period of time. Yeah. Cool. All right. So let's go to the beginning then.
Yeah.
So when do you realize that computers are a thing? Like, what's your first computer? When did you have your first computer-y experience?
Macintosh SE.
Ooh.
And I was playing Frogger on that thing. Frogger. And we had Carmen.
It was Frogger. The Frog did you.
Frogger, Carmen San Diego. And by then I was just playing games. I think games got me into programming. I wanted to make games. Games were like, I played so much games. Like, oh my gosh.
Got it.
What's weird is that I played so much games in my like teenage years. And I don't play anymore at all, no. I just like stopped playing games. I thought I'd never stop playing games, but I used to play so many games. Like,
I was the same.
Yeah.
But then, now at the kids,
I got
it's a little bit more. Yeah.
So maybe eventually when my kids get older, I'll play more games. So I have been playing a ton of games, RPGs, like everything, Age of Empires, all this stuff. And then, like around the age 9, 10, I just felt like I wanted to make one. Mm-hmm. So I went online, like, how do you make games?
There's online in the store.
I had internet. I'm not that old. I had internet. So I searched on AltaVista.
It's good. Today's program is brought to you by Alta Vista, the best search.
So how do you make games? And I found this thing called QBasic.
Okay. And then that's awesome that it was basic.
Installed QBasic, and then I made a tile-based RPG. Because that's my first thing was a tile-based RPG with a guy on screen moving around. And then that got me into programming, and I just learned like it from there. So it was QBasic.
So it was like 10, print David is awesome, 20 go to 10. Tile-based RPG. Signal.
I had found some. Exactly. That's what happened. Then I found Pascal somehow.
So were you mostly self-taught?
Yeah. Before school, because I learned myself on my own, and then we had a Pascal class.
I had Pascal in school.
You did?
Yeah. Even
really?
The olds had Pascal. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And I'm by then I had known enough to like know the basics and stuff.
Yeah.
Then I did. Let's see. I finished. So in Barbados, there's primary school.
Yeah, we should talk about that. Where's Barbados?
I didn't go to I'm from the Caribbean. I'm not from America. Me and Rihanna were in the same school.
What is it, like at the same time?
Same time, same school.
Should we?
She is 2 years younger than me.
Wow.
So if she saw me, she might go.
So she probably looks up to you.
She might actually know me. I'm not sure though. Remember, I saw her in Barbados like maybe like 4 years ago now.
Really?
And I was like, I wonder if she would know who I am.
I looked this up. So as part of wanting to look smart, like I did read the Barbados wiki page last night.
Nice.
And she's actually like, she has a title as the ambassador. Plenipotentiary.
Yes.
Which is a great word.
Yeah. So you
have something to aspire to in your career
now. We're in the same
school.
Yeah. That means stuff. So in Barbados, the way it works is you go to primary school until age 11. They make you take a test, like the SATs, to get into high school. It's kind of crazy, actually.
I guess on Wikipedia it says, I'm going to Barbados explain you for a moment.
Yeah, explain.
They said it's like in the like UK style, is that right?
Because
like an ex-colonial
You wear uniforms. You wear uniforms. You don't wear your own clothes to school. That's American.
Even a sweet pole?
No. You wear like your kicky uniform and you wear your like dress for your school. So you do a test at 11 to get into high school. You get to some high school, and then you...
They like track you, basically.
They track you,
yeah.
You can go until you're 16 or 18.
Okay.
So you can leave at 16 and go to community college and get an associate degree, or you can go through until sixth form and get your A levels, which
UK.
Is kind of like, it's in, for the UK people, it's GCSE, I think is what
it's
called.
Yeah, I heard of that.
And yeah, so there are different tests.
I'm American.
Yeah, American. So SATs are at 18, right?
You take it like junior, senior year of high school.
Okay.
Yeah, it's third and fourth year.
So what I did was I left school at 16. I went to community college. I did physics, IT, and math. And I got an associate degree in those things. And at that point, I had been doing IT, but like programming.
Got it.
And that was like where I had to do it for a class, like for real. And when I knew I wanted to do programming, like when I knew, when I like see the deal, was when I had been doing a project for our senior project, and I wanted to make a Windows GUI. And I didn't know what to do. I just like went online, Windows GUI, right?
Sure.
Just type in on the Alta Vista.
Or maybe
Google. I think Google was there by then. And this thing called Win32. And I didn't even know that I was coding in C, really. I just knew I was coding in Windows.
Because you're kind of going from the samples. Like the sample you
the
made
samples.
Too easy for Signal.
MSDN.
And now you everything.
So MSDN had code samples for everything. I could just copy and paste and run and like learn by trying things, right? And debugging. So I had been using Visual Studio.
Did you get that from school? You can say pirated. We won't. The statute of limitations is gone. We're fucked.
God. No. From, yeah. Before BitTorrent,
illicit Barbadian.
I got it from school.
Yeah, we'll go with that. We have a really good educational program where we give those things away.
And I have been up all night. I remember I was up until like 5 a.m. and I wrote this GUI in Win32 in like C. I could have used like Visual Basic. I could have used like VBA and like anything else, right? But I had done it in like C, and it felt super. I felt like. Super hardcore.
It is hardcore.
Like an actual GUI, right? Like buttons and like interactive and like drop downs and like got the whole thing working. Not ATL, none of that stuff. Just like raw Win32, right?
Wow.
And I demoed it, and my teacher was like,
in the community college.
Yeah, for class. And I demoed it, and I was so tired. I was like, I was over. I hadn't slept, like for a whole day. I was up just like glazed over. And my professor asked me like, what I use? I said Win32, and he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I just like wrote an app, and he was like, I don't believe you. Showed him the code, and he was
printed
like,
out the code on a like, dot matrix printer.
Like, no. What? Everyone else that had GUIs had to use like VBA or something else. And
got it.
And that's when I was like, oh, okay.
And so that's the, your that's next sign that like, you are maybe yeah. capable of doing something. A
and
little
I had
bit
been
more.
I had been like a TA in the class. I had been helping everyone with their programs.
I see. So I really, realistically, like if we're looking at this, there was never a doubt.
Yeah.
Computers.
If you were to ask people in my class, they would have been like, yeah.
Okay.
He's a programmer, I guess.
All right, let's shoot forward in time again. Let's talk mentors. So there was at least one in the story, right? Ebo seems like he taught you some stuff.
Yeah, super informal, but he was a really good mentor.
What was the number one thing you felt like you learned from him?
Oh, debugging skills.
Interesting.
I
tell people this all the time. I'm glad you said that.
He has some habits that were really, really good. Like, imagine you made a change to some piece of software. And you applied the change, but then it didn't like show any effect.
Yep.
First thing you do is you throw an exception in the code path, in the main code path, apply it again. Did it throw? Oh, it didn't throw. Oh, your thing isn't running. Like that technique, which is so simple. I see people debugging and they don't know it, and I'm like, oh my god, he would do it all the time. He would always ask these questions that were just like perfect. Like, did you try this? And it was like, oh. No. I should. So he taught me like really good debugging.
This is my thing. Like anytime you have any opportunity at all, I'm gonna give career advice. Darn it! Like where you can learn how to debug better, like at a conference or read blogs or whatever. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Such a good skill.
Yeah. I'm sure I learned a bunch from him. That's one that stands out because he would.
It was so obviously.
It was
on the
so.
Tip
it was so
tongue.
Like I see other people like not having that skill and going like, man, he taught me that super early. Just And he didn't teach me. I just learned from him doing it. I'm like, oh, that's how you do it. Like,
So I was the manager for the debugger team for a little while. Yeah. And like, I would always tell people, like, you know, like you're trying to explain to somebody non-technical what you do. You say, oh, yeah, I write code, which is a lie. You write code for like 5 minutes in the morning, and you spend the rest of the day trying to figure out why that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so like anything you can do in your life to like shrink that period
that time.
Is the number one thing. Yeah.
Yeah, he was amazing at debugging.
Okay,
could
cool.
Find issues, really good.
All right, best career advice.
Best career advice.
Received.
Maybe the one I got from Scott Gu, where I remember I was trying to solve a problem where I had to get a team to do a thing and I had no influence over them. So I thought I had to go like all the way up their management chain and push all the way down.
I was going to say, that's a hell of an escalation.
Because I thought to get things done, you had to like talk to your boss and your boss's boss and your boss's boss's boss and then have their boss talk across and then push down, right? Like all the way up like that.
We get to data structures around
everything. Yeah, because like you just assume like it's a tree.
Yeah, it's a parent pointer.
I can't jump to like a cousin. I have to like go all the way through the parents. So he told me some story about him and Stover like this, and him making a thing happen because he knew a guy on some other team that wasn't in his org. And just him knowing that guy and the trust between those two, like, helped them get things done.
Do you do that? Do you intentional networking behaviors, or is that sort of just something that happened from the kind of career that you had?
I try to do it more now because I see the importance of it.
Right. It's the only reason he's talking to me, right?
But I think for the most part, I hadn't tried it. It had been mostly organic.
Got it.
Yeah.
Do you have a worst career advice?
I was thinking about the worst career advice. Maybe I did have career advice that I just... Threw away.
That you like you sideswiped the disastrous.
I can't think of any like that's top of my head.
Okay, that's fine. That's all right.
I've never had bad career advice ever in my life.
All right, and we kind of talked about one, but let's talk about like in terms of making yourself more efficient. Like, what are your like top like in order to achieve what you've achieved? Like, what are your productivity hacks? Like, how do you stay effective?
Good question.
Now that you sleep sometimes.
Good. Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny, so I had kids like right in the middle of ASP.NET Core, and that was a life-changing thing, right? Because you go from like,
yes,
I used to work like crazy hours. I would work at work, work at home, like it was no break, right? People would say I still do that, but I don't do it as often as I did before. So I use my work to communicate with others, I use work to talk to the people that are at work and like figure out designs and like, figure out issues that people are having, how to solve those issues.
So you redirect more of your time towards interaction.
Yeah, I'm not coding at work. So I think I'm in a place now where I get things done like after hours that I would normally do. So either early in the morning before I start my day, I would do coding stuff. or slightly after the day's ending, when everyone's going home, I'll do some coding stuff. But during the day, I don't like coding because people are there, and I want to use them and get their brain power and get access to them at work. So I normally take a list of things that I think are things to solve, like for the next milestone or for the next week or for the next month. I put it in Notepad, and then I kind of order it.
So you do have a backlog in OneNote.
I do
that. I'm not consistent.
Bad. I just started doing it again this year. Like, I'm going to do it this year from like blah. I kind of want to like keep it around so I can see what I did.
I see.
Because I've been removing stuff as I complete it because I felt like it was a lot of overhead to have it there in the file.
Got it.
If I accomplished it.
You but filled up your OneDrive.
Yeah, but exactly. But seeing it actually made me go, I did all this stuff already this week, and I'm doing stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
You got anything else you want to share with folks in terms of career stuff?
Yeah, I'll say one thing that's interesting. I got to a point where I didn't know if I was doing any work. And I felt like I was in limbo, where I would come to work, I would talk to people, go to meetings, do stuff, and I felt like I did something. Then I get home and I go, what did I do? I didn't like have any commits. I didn't like close any bugs. I didn't do anything concrete. How are they measuring me? How are they like? How am I going to get fired soon? Are they going to find me out? Like, am I like not doing my job?
Just like that, yeah.
And then it took me maybe 2 years to realize that this is my job. Like, what I'm doing is my job. I need to go and make everyone else productive. Like, there was a blog post on Hacker News about what a principal engineer is. And it's a force multiplier. So senior dev, like you type super hard, you're technical, you get your area. You just like principal devs, like don't just type harder. They impact like the entire team in different ways, right? I think that's the big difference between like going from being a really good dev to being like someone who has to impact the entire like team or org or company. Like it's a different scale.
It's like you had to figure out how to take credit for it, you
know
what I mean? Like,
I didn't
internalize it.
I didn't know I was
that
doing.
Was work.
So, for example, I remember I wrote the prototype for the in process. In ASP.NET Core 2.2, we have a new module for IIS that runs in process. And I wrote the prototype for it, but then, like, dev wrote the actual code, and it took a while. And, like, we shipped it, and I'm like, did I do anything?
Yeah.
I recall being in the meetings just, like, agreeing on stuff, but I didn't actually write any of the code. Did I do anything? Like, was that useful?
It's great. I'm actually looking forward to getting people from all sorts of different roles. I suspect we're going to find that as we talk to people who are further along in their career, that like I certainly, that resonates with me. Like I literally sit and talk to people all day. And when I don't, that's like a bad day, actually. Yeah. It's weird.
Your kid's like, what do you do at work? And I'm like, well, I spoke to people. I went to meetings.
Yeah.
What do you do all day?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you work?
All right, cool. David, thanks for your time,
thanks.
Man. All right, rock and roll.